Okay, so let's get started here. A couple of administrative announcements. If you have been keeping track of the course webpage, you'll see that I'm actually posting lecture audio as well, just in case you haven't seen it yet. If you go to the lectures page, you can actually get the PDF as well as the audio. That will just link you to an audio file. We also set up an RSS feed, so you can get all of this as a podcast if you're interested in that. So what you have to do is actually go into iTunes, or if you're on Linux, you can. I'll post a note on what software to use. You just go into iTunes and you have to go to advanced and subscribe to a podcast. I will make the RSS URL available. You just put in a URL and then you can just get the audio. So either way is fine, your choice. I'll put a note on how to get the lectures as a podcast soon. And starting next week, hopefully we'll have video as well. Okay. So moving on to the lecture itself. Last time we were talking about threads, processes, threads, and thread scheduling. So we are going to generalize the notion of scheduling to what we are really interested in, which is distributed systems. So we will briefly look at scheduling on multiprocessors and spend a little bit of time on scheduling jobs in distributed systems, and then start talking about virtualization. So before I do this, are there any questions from the lecture last time on threads and the scheduling of threads? Any questions at all? No? Okay. So let's talk about scheduling processes or threads on a multiprocessor. Okay. So the assumption is we have a shared memory multiprocessor where there are a number of CPUs and they share a memory bank. Okay. And the other assumption is that each CPU has its own dedicated cache, an L1 cache and an L2 cache, okay, as is shown in the picture. So because the cache is not shared but memory is shared, cache performance is going to be critical, okay, in a multiprocessor. And maintaining a high level of cache hits is going to be important from a program performance standpoint, and there is some implication on this on how scheduling is done, as we will see in a moment. Okay. So in any multiprocessor, you also have to pay attention if you have a real parallel program which is multi-threaded or multi-process program, you have to worry about locks and semaphores and so on. But here we will not talk about those issues. Okay, when scheduling comes into the picture, there is also the notion of synchronization, and that also has an impact on scheduling. But we will ignore that. Okay.
What do you mean by preemption during critical sections?
So what does preemption during critical section mean? I was not going to go into a lot of detail here. But all this is saying is if you are going to implement your semi-synchronization as a spin lock, which is busy wait, you are just sitting in a loop waiting for something, so a lock to be acquired or so on. If your quantum ends at that point in time, you will get preempted. Okay, and this is typically bad because if you are in a spin lock, the assumption is you are going to get the resource in a short period of time, and you don't want to be preempted from the CPU. Okay, otherwise now you have to wait until the next quantum, and then you may lose the lock and so on. So that's the point there, but we'll not dwell on it too much. Now, the reason all of this is important is although multiprocessors or symmetric multiprocessors have been around for a long time, they are becoming really common with multi-core systems. Okay, practically any machine you buy now will have multiple cores. Okay, and it will resemble a symmetric multiprocessor in that there will be some caches that are dedicated to each processor. But the only thing is, in some multi-core system, not all caches will be dedicated. Some caches may be shared. So L1 cache is typically dedicated to that core, but L2 and L3 caches may be shared. Okay, and then, so if you don't have shared caches, then scheduling has important performance implications. Okay. Now, how would you go about scheduling, let's say, processes or threads on processors? So the assumption is there's a queue of ready tasks, ready process. By task will, or a job, we generically mean a process or a thread. Okay, rather than saying process and or thread, we'll just refer to this as a task. Okay, so there is a queue of ready tasks, and these are tasks that are ready to run. Okay, they're just waiting to get a CPU. And there are some number of processors in a multi-core or multi-CPU system. So the assumption is, in the simplest case, you will have one queue. And whenever a quantum on any processor ends, that processor will then look at the ready queue and get the next task that is ready to run and execute it for another quantum and so on. Okay? Very simple idea. This is the same thing that is done in a uniprocessor system. Okay, that's what we were talking about last time. Now this is shown as a single logical queue, but in a multi-level feedback queue, this could be multiple queues, but that's not important. What is important is there is one central place where all ready tasks are available, and then the processor is just going to look at that queue and get the next task and run it. Okay. Now the problem with this approach in a multiprocessor or a multi-core system is that as the number of cores or the number of processors increases, the ready queue becomes a bottleneck.
Yes. Is this queue a particular processor?
Queue is in memory. This is a memory data structure. Because it's a shared memory multiprocessor. Yes. Because it's a shared memory multiprocessor, anything in memory can be accessed by any processor. Right? That's the assumption. So this is just a kernel data structure. It is stored in memory. Now I claim that as the number of processors or cores increases, this is going to be a bottleneck. Okay, reason should be clear. Because this is a shared data structure, access to it is going to be protected by a lock. Okay, because you are just taking things and adding things to the queue, you have to do it by first getting a lock. And as the number of processors increases, contention for locks is going to increase, which means that if some other processor is currently holding a lock and your quantum ends, you have to wait for the lock, you are wasting CPU cycle. The CPU is going to be idle waiting for a lock. Okay, and now you're wasting these cycles and your utilization is going to go down. Okay. So that's one problem. So to address this problem, what people did is they said, let's not have one single queue for the entire system, but we could have a queue, multiple queues. Okay. In the extreme case, you have one queue for each processor. Okay. What is shown here is some generalization where each queue is shared by some k processors, where k is smaller than n. N is the number of processors in the system. But for simplicity, let's just take one queue per processor. Okay, that's one end of the spectrum. Now, in this case, there is no problem. Okay, in the sense that you will have each processor has a ready queue. When that quantum ends, you just look at your local queue and just get the next task. Okay, so contention problem is gone. No question. Yeah, so we'll come. So question is, who decides which process goes to which queue? So this is at the crux of the problem with a distributed queue. So what is going to be an issue here is, how many tasks do you put in each of these queues? Ideally, you want these queues to be load balanced, so all processors are going to be sharing the overall load equally. Okay? But this is not completely under your control. When you come in, a new task come in, let's say is randomly assigned to a queue, or let's say is assigned to the least loaded queue. Okay? But as tasks come and go, by come and go, I mean they may block, in which case they get taken out of the ready queue and they go into a blocked queue. Yeah, and when tasks become runnable or they unblock, then they come back to the ready queue. The number of tasks in your queue is going to fluctuate over time. Okay? And so this means that some queues may have, let's say, only two tasks, and other queues may have many tasks. Okay? So this also impacts the fraction of CPU time each task is seeing in the system. If the ready queue for a processor is small, those tasks are getting proportionately more CPU cycles than if the ready queue is large, assuming you do round robin. Okay, within a queue, you get 1 over n of the CPU time, where n is the number of tasks in the queue. As n grows, you get lower and lower fraction of the CPU for that processor. Okay? So in other words, what this is saying is you have to periodically rebalance, okay, by looking at all queues and looking at what the sizes of these queues are, and then try to rebalance so that the sizes of these queues is approximately equal. Okay? Now that's the disadvantage of this approach. The advantage is that you will not have contention. Disadvantage is there may be unfairness in the system, where some queues will be smaller because maybe more of those tasks all happen to block concurrently. So there are fewer tasks, they get to run more frequently. Okay, question is.
So does every processor have a dedicated block queue, or is the block queue like common? I'm trying to understand.
So in the second model, you have one queue per processor in the ideal sort of the extreme case. What is shown here is one queue per every k processors. Okay, so you could obviously share a queue, but in the extreme case, you will have only one queue per processor. Here, there is no lock required. Okay, assuming this is the only CPU touching that queue, you don't need a lock. Only when you rebalance across the whole system, you get a global lock. You rebalance and then you release all the locks.
Okay, that's it. The process is not assigned to any other process.
No. In this case, if a process is basically in this queue, it will run, and if it's ready to run, it just goes to the end of the queue and you will just... Right. So if it is blocked? If it's blocked, it just goes to the blocked queue. You do the IO, when it's ready to run, you just put it back. Yes. Until you are rebalanced and go to another queue, you will stay in your queue. Okay. So now this is, these two schemes look at overheads of the approach. Okay, but there are important performance implications which come in when you talk about the cache. Okay. Now, why is the cache important in a multiprocessor? So, suppose that a task is running on a particular CPU. Okay, if you go back to this picture here, okay, let's say there's a task running here. Okay, as it runs, code and data is fetched from the memory and it is cached here. And this improves the performance because every time you do a memory access, either to get more instructions or to access data, you don't have to go to memory, but you go to a cache, an L1 or an L2 cache, which is very fast. Okay, so performance, caches will improve performance. Okay. Now, if you go to the centralized queue approach, in this approach, there is no guarantee that the next time the task is going to run, it is going to run on that processor. Okay. Because you are just scheduling tasks in round robin order. Whenever a CPU becomes idle, it just picks the next available task from the queue. Okay? So if the task ran on this processor the first time around, it may run on some other processor the next time around. So it is starting from a cold cache. Okay? So every time it changes processor, the cache becomes cold, you will incur cache misses. Okay? And you will incur the penalty of, or you will incur the performance penalty of cache misses. Okay. This is a big problem with centralized queues, okay, because that can have a dramatic impact on application performance. On the other hand, in the second approach, or when you have a single queue per processor, this is not a problem because you are running on the same processor. Okay. The next time you run, unless you have been moved to another CPU for load balancing reasons, you will stay in your queue, you will use the same cache, okay, and presumably the cache is still warm. Okay. So you will not have this problem. Okay. Yes.
So
question.
For the parents, how to evaluate the parents, such as the task number or some other things?
So how to evaluate the balance? I mean, this is typically done by just simplest scenario is you just balance the number of tasks. Okay, that's the easiest. There are many other policies, but we will not go into them. Any questions here on the cache issue? So in other words, there is this notion of cache affinity, which says try to schedule a task on the same processor where it executed last. So you get the benefit of a warm cache. Okay, this is referred to as affinity to a processor or affinity to a cache. Okay, and this is something all schedulers try to exploit in order to give good performance. If you don't, then you are going to see performance penalties for your applications. Is this clear? Okay. So now we are going to generalize this notion. So we started with, last class we started with multiple threads, single processor. What we talked about right now was multiple tasks, multiple CPUs. Next we are going to look at multiple tasks, multiple machines. And that is where we come look at distributed scheduling. Okay. And the idea here is very similar to the multiprocessor, but the techniques will be very different. So we will assume that there are multiple CPUs in your system. Okay? But in a distributed system, the CPUs will be on independent machines. Okay? Not on this. In a multiprocessor, they were on one machine, but they are all on different machines. Okay? And we want to ask the same problem. Okay? Each machine has its own kernel and has its own queue. Okay? And it's scheduling some tasks. Okay? There is another machine that's scheduling some other task. The question we want to ask is, when do you want to run a task on the machine that it currently is executing versus when do you want to move it to some other machine in order to load balance the system? Okay? If there are scenarios where certain machines are heavily loaded, there are lots of tasks they are running, and other machines are completely idle, it makes sense to offload some of those tasks to this other machine so that the system as a whole is balanced and you are making good use of your resources. Okay? This is the problem of distributed scheduling. Okay, so we will ask the question as to how will you go about balancing the load in the system by moving tasks from one machine to another. Okay, so you get good overall, let's say, response time or throughput. It's clear, right? So the assumption is there are n workstations. So we'll just to make it this more explicit, you have a network of workstation or a cluster of workstations. So there will be n of these. Okay? Each is acting, each has its own processor, and it may be more than one, and it has its own operating system. Okay, so there's a local run queue that is there on each machine. And then we want to now, for the purposes of just this slide, let's assume that you can model this as an MM1 system where tasks are locally arriving, they're getting scheduled, and they depart after some period of time. Okay? And then the utilization, let's say, is U of a local machine. Now the question, first question we want to ask is, does it even make sense to come up with a complex scheme where you are trying to move tasks across machines? Because this is not going to be easy to implement. It is going to add complexity to your system as well as application. Okay, when does it even make sense to do this? That you just take some tasks that are running on one workstation and move to some other workstation. Okay, under what scenarios is it beneficial? So we will, to understand this, let's look at this question that is put up on this slide. And the question is, what is the probability that at least one system is idle and there's one job waiting on some other system? Okay. The claim is, under this scenario, distributed scheduling makes sense. Okay. If there are scenarios where some machines are idle and other machines have waiting jobs, which means that they have a load of number of tasks is greater than one, then it makes sense to move some tasks from these machines to the idle machines. Okay, and then you get the benefit of balancing the load and making good use of resources. So the question is, under what scenarios would you even see this, both of these conditions being true, that there are some idle machines as well as there are some loaded ones. Okay. Now, we'll come back to this graph in just a moment. So let's think about, so to understand this, you can analyze various operating regions for the system as a whole. Okay. So let's take the high utilization region. Okay, the system as a whole is heavily utilized. Okay. So under this scenario, it is going to be very likely that most machines have more than one task. Okay, meaning that most machines will have some task that is executing while there are some tasks that are waiting. Okay, because system is loaded. Is this clear? But at the same time, since the system utilization is high as well, the probability that there is any one system, any one machine that's idle is going to be very small. Okay, because most machines are loaded, so finding an idle machine is not going to be easy. Okay. So under this scenario, okay, this condition is true in most cases on machines, but this condition is not true. Okay. So you will basically get lots of machines that are willing to offload their tasks, but there are no machines to accept these tasks. No idle machines to accept this. So under this scenario, distributed scheduling doesn't make sense. Okay, because you may come up with a nice algorithm, but there is no other machine to run these tasks on, so you are not going to get any benefit whatsoever. Okay. So now if you take the other scenario, which is low utilization, okay, again the claim is that distributed scheduling will not be very useful, because when the system as a whole has very low utilization, there are lots of idle machines, and there are very few machines that have more than one task that they want to offload. Okay, so the opposite is true, which is that this condition becomes true for most machines, that system is idle, but there are no jobs to send to these machines. So if there is nothing to send, your distributed scheduler has no work to do. So your scheduling is not going to give you any additional benefit. You may as well just do local scheduling. Okay? So in both very high utilization scenarios as well as low utilization scenarios, local scheduling gives you most of the benefit. Distributed scheduling doesn't give you any additional benefit, or gives you very little additional benefit. That is effectively what this graph is showing. That's the probability distribution of both of those conditions being true. At low utilization, the probability that condition is true is low. At high utilization, it's also low. But somewhere in the middle, if you have moderate utilization, there may be some machines that are more loaded than others, and there will be some machines that may be idle, so you may get some benefit. So the operating region where these techniques even help is when the system as a whole is moderately utilized. In high or low utilization regions, you will not get much benefit. Question.
After trying to picture how you will have a global view of all systems, how will you know what the utilization of other systems?
Yes. Question is, how will you know what the utilization of other systems is? Let's come to the techniques. We are just talking concepts right now, right? So how we look at distributed schedulers, we didn't talk about any. We're just trying to understand under what scenarios this is even useful as a technique. So when we do that, we'll talk about that. Is this clear what we talked about? Okay. So there are many design issues. So now the next step is, let's assume there will be systems that are moderately loaded where you want to put this to use. Okay, now how would you go about designing a distributed scheduler? Okay, so there are many design choices. How will you measure the load? Okay, you can, what metric will you use? Queue length at the CPU, CPU utilization, there are many metrics. Okay, there's also the question that was just raised, how will you share this information across machines? Okay, because other machines have to know what's happening locally to make these decisions. Okay. What is the policy itself going to do? Okay, static policy typically not very good. Decisions of how to offload any tasks is hardwired. Okay, if you are loaded, go to machine 10 and give it your job. That's not a very useful policy. Okay? So the two that we are going to look at are dynamic and adaptive. In a dynamic policy, we will use load information to dynamically decide which tasks to send somewhere else and which machines to send them to. Okay? In the adaptive system, the policy itself is going to vary based on the load. Okay? Not only are you going to decide where to send tasks dynamically, but the policy itself may change. You may just change the algorithm you use to do the scheduling on the fly. Okay? Then there is preemptive versus non-preemptive. Are you going to preempt a task that is already running and send it off to another machine? Or are you going to wait until it ends and then run another job? Is centralized versus decentralized? Is your scheduler centralized where all machines just send their load information to one central node? It has a global view of the system and it decides saying machine I should send 3 tasks to machine J. Okay? That's a centralized policy. Now fully decentralized or a distributed policy, decisions are made locally. Okay? So you decide whether you want to offload tasks or receive tasks. Okay? And you have some knowledge of what is going on in the system, but not full, very accurate knowledge. And you want the system to be stable. Okay, and then that's an important issue. So what that means is that if there are jobs that you're offloading, you don't want to offload it to machine J and machine J suddenly decides now it is loaded, so it basically offloads it to some other machine and your job just floats around in the system without getting executed. Okay, that's an example of an unstable policy. You want to offload your tasks and have them run. Okay, so you want to make good decisions. So these are some design issues, and we will now talk about 3 different policies, okay? A sender initiated, receiver initiated, and an adaptive or symmetric policy. And all of these policies can be understood based on 4 dimensions, okay? The first one is what's called a transfer policy, which is how does this algorithm decide when to transfer a process, when to start offloading your tasks to some other machine. Typically, you use threshold based. If your load rises above a certain threshold, you decide you're overloaded and you try to offload some tasks. Okay, very simple. That's what many of them use. The next thing is selection policy, which says which process to transfer. Okay, you have some number of tasks here in the queue. Which of these? So you want decided you want to offload some of these. Which one will you pick and send somewhere else? Okay. And then we'll see that most of them use new processes, tasks that have just arrived but haven't yet started executing. Because moving executing tasks is more complex, as we will see also see. Yeah. Third dimension is location policy, which is you want to now you pick the task, which machine are you going to send it to? Okay, which machine are you going to pick? And we'll see there are many ways to decide which machine to use. And the fourth one is information policy. That was the question that was raised, saying what information do you know about the system in order to make all of these decisions? Okay, which task to send, where to send? Do you have some load information about others that you can make these decisions in a reasonable fashion? Okay? And there are many possibilities here. It's demand driven, that you exchange information only on demand. There's a time driven, which says every 1 minute send your load information, broadcast it to all the machines. This is basically a time driven. State chain driven says that if some significant things happen, then only you should broadcast. If your load goes above the threshold that you have picked, okay, suddenly now you become, go from underloaded to overloaded, that's what you should broadcast. If it goes from 30% utilization to 31% utilization, that's not really important. Okay, as far as other machines are concerned, you may still be underloaded. So there are various policies, and we'll look at which ones make sense in what sort of scenarios. Okay, so we'll start with the sender initiated algorithm. Okay, and in this case, what a sender initiated says is that the machine that becomes overloaded decides to send its load elsewhere. Okay, that's what a sender initiated algorithm does. Transfer policy, very simple, threshold based. Whenever new jobs are submitted, if that number of tasks is lower than a threshold or utilization is lower than a threshold, execute locally. Otherwise, decide to transfer. Okay. If you are basically underloaded, arriving tasks get executed locally. If you are above a threshold, your load is above a threshold, you decide to send this task elsewhere. Okay, that's your transfer policy. Selection policies, you only pick newly arrived process, just to simplify things. Okay. You are not going to take processes that have already started executing and start transferring them. Okay, that's more challenging, as we will see. Okay. And the location policy, there are many variants here. Okay, the simplest location policy is random. Okay, you decide that you want to move a task. Just pick one machine at random and just send your task to that machine. Okay. Now it works many times, but sometimes you may pick a machine that is already overloaded, and if you send it the job, it has to then transfer it elsewhere. Okay, so that's the disadvantage of random. Okay, in the random policy, no information is needed about the system. Okay. You don't have to exchange any information because you're just picking a machine at random. Now, you could also do probing, which is where you now ask n nodes sequentially, saying, are you willing to accept a task? If the answer is no, you move on to another machine. Are you willing to accept a task? And you do this until you find some machine that has a low enough load that it wants to accept your task, and then you send it there. Okay? So this is sequential probing. You can also probe in parallel. And you just broadcast or multicast your request to n nodes. They all send you their load information, and you pick the least loaded one. Okay, so this is how you would figure out what the load information is and where to send your task. Is this clear? Questions?
So how are these n nodes chosen?
How are these n nodes chosen? That, I mean, this is a very generic policy. We'll talk about specific implementations. You could decide that, as we'll see. If you have load information is being broadcast, you can keep a list of n lowest loaded machines and pick those. Okay. Now, receiver initiated policy is the exact opposite. Here, idle machines go around looking for work. Okay, so they are receivers of tasks, they are looking for tasks. Okay. Transfer policy is if a departing task causes your load to fall below a low threshold, you have claimed that you are now idle enough to accept new jobs, and now you go around looking for jobs as a machine. Okay, so that's the transfer policy. Selection policy is you are always willing to accept newly arrived jobs. You could also do partially executed, but as I mentioned, once a job starts executing, moving it is much harder. Okay, now location policy is the same. If you want to accept a task, you can probe n nodes saying, do you have a task to send? Are you overloaded? Okay, if some node decides to send, then you accept it. Okay, so you could basically do sequential probes, or you could do parallel probes and pick the most heavily loaded machine and say, okay, you are the most loaded, so send me a task. Okay, so this is how you would use. And in this case, again, load information is being queried on demand. Okay, there is nothing that is being broadcast ahead of time. Only when you need to, you go query nodes and get their load information and decide who should send you that job. Okay. So the next policy is a hybrid, which basically has both. Okay, you have a question there.
What is the number of tasks that is sent from a sender to a receiver? Like, yeah, one at a time?
Yeah, what is the number of tasks? So for simplicity, assume it's one at a time. Okay. But of course, that can be generalized. So the next policy is what we'll call symmetric. Okay, this has both of these schemes operating at the same time, and you can be a sender or a receiver depending on what your load is at any given time. Okay, so there are two thresholds. There's a low threshold and there's a high threshold. If your load goes above a high threshold, you become a sender and you actively look for nodes to send your job. If your load goes below a low threshold, you become a receiver and you actively go around looking for jobs. Okay? So the assumption here is basically you will keep track of where your threshold is. If you're in the middle, you do nothing. You're just neither a sender nor a receiver. You're just executing jobs locally. Okay? So if you become a sender, you can go and start probing and then accept jobs. You become a receiver, you again start probing and ask for jobs. Okay? Now, you could also do something a little more intelligent, which is periodically broadcast, are you a sender, receiver, or neither? Okay? So other nodes can then keep lists of who are receivers and who are senders. Okay? And only probe those. So for example, if you become a receiver, rather than picking n nodes at random, you can use the information that was sent to you and only look for receivers. Alternately, if you are a receiver, you can look at a sender list and only probe them. Okay? So this makes it a little easier. When your system size grows, you don't have to send unnecessary queries to other machines. Okay? You can only send, so you pick the other type of node, only ask for those nodes, whether they are jobs to send or whether they are willing to receive. Okay? So this is an adaptive policy. Here, depending on your load, you become a sender or a receiver and you basically choose that one of the previous two algorithms to execute. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So now with these three concepts, okay, so all three policies were very simple and conceptual. So let's look at two specific case studies. Okay, and these are systems that were implemented that made use of these ideas, okay, and they actually instantiate them, and we are going to see what they did. Okay. First one is the V system. This is a system that was built at Stanford University about 10-15 years back. Okay, it's a fairly old system, no longer in use, but I think it actually implements these policies that we talked about, the distributed scheduling policies. Okay. So now in this case, what happens is it actually implements a variant of what we just talked about. And the information policies, what information to propagate, is state change driven. Okay. So what that means is every time you cross the boundary here, either you cross the low threshold or high threshold, you broadcast this saying, I have now become a sender, or I am no longer a sender, I have become a receiver. This information is then broadcast to everyone. Okay. And so that every node now has a list of senders, receivers, or neither. Okay, so you have three lists that you maintain. Whereas as broadcasts come in, you update these lists. Okay? And then of this list, you basically in the receiver list, you pick the m least loaded nodes. Okay? And those are the nodes you are going to probe if you become a sender. Okay? And others are assumed to be senders. So in the sender initiated case, you will basically pick a newly arrived job and you will probe these n receivers, pick one of them at random and probe them. Are you still a receiver? The answer is yes, then you will basically just send a job. Because you already know that these are the least loaded. You don't probe them in parallel. You just pick one of them at random and you see if they are still in the same state. And if so, you send the job. Okay? Otherwise, you try another machine from that list. Okay, that's basically what they did. Okay, very simple instantiation of the idea. So the Sprite system, which was developed around the same time, this was actually an entire operating system, also implemented a distributed schedule. Okay, so this was one of the early distributed operating systems. And this implemented a distributed scheduler. And the assumption here was it was a network of workstation environment. Okay, so what was assumed as every user has his or her workstation. And whenever they are using their workstation actively, only local jobs are executed. Okay, meaning that anything you want to run on your node, you run. Nobody else is going to send you job. But if your workstation is idle, okay, let's assume that you go for lunch, or you go home for the night, then you have nothing running on the machine, workstation becomes idle. In this case, it's willing to accept jobs. Okay, so it basically then you use the idle CPU cycles on that idle workstation to get jobs and execute, get remote jobs and execute. Okay, Okay? And the assumption is the moment you come back to your workstation again becomes your own resource. Meaning if there is some other job that is running, it has to stop and move to some other machine. Okay? So in other words, this was basically a scheduling algorithm that went around harvesting idle CPU cycles. Okay? And so long as you use your machine, it's all yours. Nobody gets to run any job on your machine. But if it's idle, you donate your CPU cycles to a pool and somebody uses those cycles if there are jobs to send. Okay, and as soon as you come back to your machine, you get it back. That's the assumption. Okay, that's what I mean by owner is king, that you own the machine at all times, but when you're not using it, you lend it to someone else to run their job. Okay. Now, this was a centralized policy, not a distributed one. Okay, there was a centralized coordinator that kept track of all of the state of all of the machines in the system. Okay. So this policy was also state change driven, which means that you have to broadcast your load information that told the centralized coordinator whether you are a sender or a receiver. Okay. So when do you become a receiver? If you are a workstation and there is no keyboard activity for 30 seconds, okay, meaning that you have not done anything on your machine for half a minute, and the load is less than a threshold, which means the number of active processes is less than some value, then you become a receiver. Okay, which means you have no keyboard or mouse input, effectively you are not using your machine, and the load on that machine is less than a threshold, then your machine is idle and available for use. In this case, you broadcast that you have become a receiver, not broadcast, but rather just send that information to the coordinator, saying I am willing to accept jobs. Okay, so at this point, the sender can query the coordinator saying, do you have jobs to send? And then if so, the job actually arrives, it executes. Okay, but the moment you come back and there is any keyboard or mouse input, that job has to be suspended and sent back to the coordinator saying, I've executed this job partially, run it elsewhere. Okay, because the user is back using their machine. Yes. Selection policy. So selection policy is where to send jobs. You could specify this. In the Sprite environment, you could run a job locally, or you could actually specify where to start the job. This is equivalent of SSH and start a job. So they had that facility in there. Okay. That's just the initial location where the job starts executing. Okay. Beyond this, it can hop around machines as the load changes. Okay. Is this clear, what I just said? Now, the important thing I just said here is that jobs can be suspended at any arbitrary point and sent to another machine. Okay? Now, this is easier said than done, because when a process has started executing, it already has some memory state. Okay? It has executed to some point in time. We are effectively suspending that task, okay, and resuming execution elsewhere. That's saying you suspend this process, you move the entire process somewhere else, and you resume execution of that process exactly where it left off. Okay. So, in other words, Sprite supported process migration. Okay. Process migration is a technique where you can migrate a currently executing process to some other machine and resume execution elsewhere. So, suppose you have a make that you started, it's compiling some job, you can suspend it at any point and resume it elsewhere. Or any arbitrary program can suspend it and resume elsewhere. This most operating systems today don't support this feature. It is not very cheap to implement. Nevertheless, Sprite did support it. We will come back to process migration in more detail in the next class. But just to understand what it does, so you effectively, if you want to transfer a process to another machine, you have to swap its entire memory state, dump it to disk. Okay? And then that means then you have to send all of the page tables and file descriptors and what files are open and so on to the other machine. You have to load all of the pages, demand page, all of the things that you put to disk and resume execution. Okay? Now, if the task is actually has some network connection, it has open sockets and so on, this makes it even harder. Okay? Because a socket is tied to an IP address and an endpoint. You just move the process to some other machine that has a different IP address. The connection is still established to the previous machine. Okay? So, that complicates matters even more. But if there is no network activity, if it's a compute bound job, which really doesn't have other most network activity, if you do this conceptually, you can move a process. You save its memory state on disk, okay, and move that state elsewhere, load it back and resume execution. Okay, we'll see how to do this in the next class. But this is effectively what Sprite did. Yes, question.
Is there a special benefit of doing process migration?
there a specific benefit? You do it to do load balancing, right? So that's why you need to do it. If you become overloaded and you say, I want to suspend this task and move it to some other machine, you are already running, you are a process, you have to migrate that process.
But then, if there's something in queue, you start processing that? Or if you're already processing something, why would you want to stop it?
So that's precisely what I said here, right? So you have a workstation. Okay, you walk away from your workstation, you go to lunch. Okay, your workstation becomes idle, it starts accepting jobs. Okay, so a job comes in, it starts executing. And you come back to your workstation, it's still executing. So as soon as you come back, you get back your machine. This is a foreign job. So you have to suspend it and you have to run it elsewhere. But it's already a process. So one thing you could do is just kill the process and start the job from the beginning. Okay, that's an easy thing to do. But that means all of the CPU cycle that you spent have just gone waste. Better thing is you suspend execution and resume this process on another machine. That is what process migration is going to give you.
This process migration includes the pages movement.
Does a process migration involve pages? Yes. You swap the entire memory state and you move it to another machine and you resume execution elsewhere.
What happens if there's a pointer?
What happens if there's a pointer? The virtual pointers are all virtual addresses, right? So all of them should work fine.
But they refer to memory addresses in one particular system, right? So what happens if it goes to another system?
Yes, you have to deal with that issue. Most of the time, if the pointers are, since you're actually referring to a page within your address space, this is not a problem. Okay, because I mean, you will basically have a virtual address. Pointer is pointing to virtual address within the memory. And you will just go on another machine, you will load the same thing. Right, so you will basically be able to access that memory location in your address space. So this is, let's say you are a process address space, there's a pointer P, okay, star P, is pointing to this location. This whole thing is moved to another machine, so it will still point to that location, okay, within your address space.
So you didn't say distributed file system also, then the file system will
yes.
have locks.
Right. So this requires a distributed file system, because what happens effectively is Sprite had a file system that you moved your state to disk, but the file system was shared across all machines, so another machine could access the same file immediately. You didn't have to do a lot of copying. Otherwise, you would have to copy this entire state, which would have even higher overhead. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, adding more to that, it adds also complications. Say I lock some file on this machine, and locking in a distributed file system, lock would be according to the machine. Now I have migrated the process to a new machine, the lock actually is taken by that machine.
Right. So all of this you have to rethink in this world, right? If you cannot tie locks to machine, neither can you tie socket connections to machine. They have to be tied to a process as opposed to IP address that doesn't move with you. So you have to re-architect all of these things. Yes, both the vSystem paper and the Sprite paper are on the additional reading list. If you really want to know all of the details, you can go to the course reading list, the link that says reading list, and get these papers. Okay, so they all describe how this was done in fair amount of detail. Okay. So in the remaining half hour, I'm going to talk about virtualization. And there's a good reason we are moving from distributed scheduling to virtualization, as you will see when we come towards the end of the topic on virtualization. Well, virtualization makes some of the scheduling decisions that we have been talking about much, much easier under certain scenarios, okay, migration and so on. But we will take a very systematic approach to virtualization and look at various types of virtualization, how they work, and then come back to this idea of migration and scheduling. Okay. So what is virtualization? Okay, how do we define it? Effectively, a virtualization extends or replaces an existing interface with another. Okay, another interface that mimics the behavior of another system. So this is most easily shown by this picture. Okay, so here is system A. Okay, the system A has a certain hardware architecture, and a certain software system, a certain operating system. Okay. This operating system exports some interface. Okay, this could be an operating system or some other runtime system. Okay, that exports an interface that is used by the program. If that software system is an operating system, this interface is the system call interface. If it's a runtime system, that interface is, let's say, the libraries it exports. Okay. And the application is using this interface to run on this hardware and software. Okay. Now suppose that there is a new version of the hardware or a new version of the software that has gotten released, which is shown in this picture. So this is system B. Either the hardware has changed or the operating system has changed, or both have changed. Okay. So the interface now that's exported is B, which is different from A. Okay. So it should be clear that this application is no longer going to run there, because the interface is different. It cannot interact with the OS and the hardware. Okay. So to make it run unmodified, what you could do is we could add a layer. Okay. That layer effectively exports interface A and re-implements that interface A with the interface B. Okay. In other words, the calls that are part of A are mimicked or re-implemented using B. Okay. Now the program can run unmodified because it is still making all of the calls of interface A. There's a wrapper here which is just taking all of the B's and mapping them to rather all of the calls of A and mapping them to equivalent calls in B. Okay, is this clear? What has just happened? Now, so this is effectively what virtualization does. So that's what we said. We replace one interface with another that mimics the behavior of a second system. So basically, although this program was written for a different hardware or a different operating system, it can run unmodified because you added a virtualization layer. What this virtualization layer does is that to this program, it gives it the abstraction as if it's still running on system A. But in reality, it's running on system B, but the application doesn't know this, because this virtualization layer is hiding the details of this translation from the application. Okay, is this clear? So a question is, why would you want to do all this? Right? What does it give you? It looks like there is a lot more complexity and so on. So this idea was introduced in the 70s by IBM for their mainframe systems. Okay, this has been around for a long time now. And the reason to do this was to allow legacy software to run on newer hardware. Okay? So the mainframes were sort of the big computing machines that you would use in organization. So suppose you have spent a lot of effort and lot of manpower and money to write an application for your organization. Okay? So this application runs and now your machine has gotten old, so you want to replace it with a different machine. Okay? Since hardware keeps changing over time, okay, when you buy another machine, it may have a different hardware. It may have different hardware features, even the OS may be different. Okay? But as an organization, you don't want to reinvest effort re-implementing that application on the second newer hardware. Okay? That takes a lot of money from an organization standpoint. So what IBM did is they kept changing the hardware and the OS, but in order to let you run your old applications without any modification, they added this virtualization. So there were several generations of these mainframe architectures that came out that kept changing the underlying hardware, the underlying instruction sets and so on. But all old applications could run unmodified. So you have no problem buying this machine because you know all your applications run anyway. They may run slightly slower because you have to now go through this translation interface, but they nevertheless run, and since the hardware is faster, maybe this overhead of virtualization doesn't show up in application performance. Okay? This was their initial motivation to develop virtualization. Okay? So you could actually take applications that were written maybe many, many years back and continue to run them through the entire sequence of hardware architectures that they put out, okay? Unmodified. And this was very appealing to organizations because they could upgrade, but your application didn't have to change. Okay? This gives you portability and flexibility without changing the application, which is very important. Okay? Now, this is an idea that came about in the 70s, but it has reappeared in a different form now. Okay? So we'll look at virtualization in the modern days as to what they do and how they do it. Okay? So I said that virtualization at its very core is extending or replacing an interface to mimic the behavior of another. So the interface that we care about could be at the hardware level, in which case it's the instruction sets themselves that are getting translated, or it could be at the operating system level, in which case it's the system calls that are getting translated. One interface is being used to mimic another set of system calls, or it could be at the library level where you are replacing one set of library functions with another. Okay? So you could do this remapping at any of these three layers, and depending on where you do it, you get different types of virtualization, either hardware level virtualization or OS level virtualization or application level virtualization. Okay? So there are virtualization falls into various categories, and it depends on what interface you are replacing or attempting to emulate. Clear? So we will look at actually these two layers first, and that layer we'll come back to at the very end. Okay. So I'm going to now provide a taxonomy of virtualization along the lines of what I just discussed. Okay. So how would you go about doing this? Okay. The first form of virtualization is what is called full emulation. Okay. What happens in full emulation is that the virtualization layer that I've been talking about, let's call it a virtual machine or a VM. Okay. In full emulation, VM is going to simulate complete set of hardware. Okay. In other words, you re-implement everything a hardware does in software, meaning a CPU and the memory and all the disk access. Everything is basically implemented in hardware. Re-implemented in software. So what happens here is that an unmodified guest operating system can run on a different PC. Okay. So an example of emulation is there is this box project which is open source, is QEMU, and virtual PC for the Mac. Okay, this is a good example to understand what emulation does. Okay. Earlier versions of Macs ran on the PowerPC architecture, a different CPU. What Power Virtual PC on the Mac does is that it emulates an Intel x86 PC on a PowerPC architecture. So you can run x86 applications and x86 operating systems on PowerPC machines. In other words, you can run Windows, although Windows is designed for Intel x86, unmodified on a PowerPC system. Okay. And the virtualization layer is doing a full implementation of an x86 processor in software. Okay, so every x86 instruction is actually getting emulated at the software level, and is doing equivalent things that it would do on an x86 machine, but it's using power. This program is written in PowerPC. Okay. That is what emulation does. Okay. Now, full native virtualization. So that's at one end of the spectrum. You do full emulation of the hardware. Okay, so you can emulate any hardware on any other set of hardware. This is going to be slow, okay, because every instruction is now being replaced by a set of PowerPC instructions that emulated. Okay. Now, the next set of things we'll look at are more efficient than this. In full or native virtualization, what VM does is that we assume that you are on the same hardware family now. Okay. Here, the hardware family itself can change. Okay. In full or native virtualization, the hardware family is the same. So, you are emulating enough hardware to allow an unmodified guest to run in isolation. Okay. So, what does this mean? You are basically emulating the same interface on that interface. Okay. So, in other words, interface A and interface B are actually the same interfaces. They are not different, because the hardware family is identical. Okay. Question is, why would you do this? Why are you taking the trouble of re-implementing the same interface in software?
For safety.
Isolation. So this basically both are correct, but what they are pointing to is what this allows you to do is run multiple operating systems in parallel. Okay. That is the reason you do this emulation. So each is going to run on its own virtual machine, and they can all share the hardware, which you couldn't do if you ran on a physical machine. Okay. So the IBM VM family does this. VMware Workstation, Parallels, they all do this. Okay. Now, the next one we are going to talk about is para-virtualization. Okay. And what happens in para-virtualization is the virtual machine does not really simulate the hardware, but instead it exposes a special API that a modified guest operating system must do. So in this case, the OS is not going to be unmodified anymore. You actually modify the OS and use a special API to communicate with the virtual machine. And we'll talk about this in more detail in a few moments. And so there is the notion of a hypercall, okay, which is similar to a system call. So there's a hypercalls are trapped by the hypervisor and serviced, and this allows you to do emulation. And we'll see how this works in just one second. But before that, let's talk about these other two types. So OS level virtualization, now we are going to rise above the hardware level. So all of these techniques that we talked about, okay, emulation, full and para virtualization, we're implementing re-implementing an interface at this level. Okay. Now, if you think about the system call level, then you get the next level of virtualization, which is OS level. So in this case, the operating system allows multiple virtual servers to run, and each is given full isolation. You are not re-implementing a hardware, but you just give an abstraction as if you are running by yourself on the machine and there is nothing else running. So that's what it is doing. The guest OS and the host OS are actually the same. There are no two operating systems, it's just one, but you give this isolation. So application see an isolated OS. So the notion of Solaris containers or BSD jails or Linux vServer does this. So what happens here is effectively, just to draw a picture here. So you have the OS. When you create a virtual server, you basically just draw a boundary. And an app running here cannot get any access to an app running in this container. Because you just have this container. In this container, it looks like this is the only process that is running on the system. If you do top or PS or so on, you only get access to the processes that are running in this container and not in that. You can also virtualize the file system, where each of these containers get their own root file system. This is a virtual file system. So all of the files here are isolated from all of the files in that container and so on. So here you are basically providing protection and isolation, and you are basically creating this notion of a jail or a container that isolates your applications. That is what OS level virtualization does. And all of these operating systems support it. You can use them. Now at the application level virtualization, you have risen to the next level. You are now at the library level. So each application is given its own copy of the components that are not shared. Simplest example of this is a JVM. Java Virtual Machine is an application level virtual machine. Because virtualization is all happening at the application level, you get the Java interface that's exported by the JVM to Java application. And the JVM itself uses the lower level system call interface or some other libraries to implement the JVM. That's the way to think about it. So now what we are going to do is the two that are of most interest to us is this full and native virtualization and para virtualization. Those are the ones we are going to look at in quite some detail and understand how they actually implement this notion of virtualization or emulation of the hardware. So let's take native virtualization first. And even with a native virtualization, there are two ways to implement native virtualization that are shown in this picture. We'll call them as type 1 and type 2 native virtualization. So in any virtualization, there's this notion of a virtual machine monitor or the hypervisor. This is the layer that is doing the re-implementation of the interface for us. We'll call that layer as the hypervisor. In type 1 virtualization, the hypervisor runs on bare metal, meaning it is running on the physical hardware. It is equivalent to an operating system kernel, which is runs on pure hardware. Here, the hypervisor takes that role and it runs on bare metal. And there are multiple virtual machines that can be created on top of this, and each would run its own operating system and its own application. Here you show two VMs, one is running Windows, the other one is running Linux. And both are multiplexed by this type 1 hypervisor. Type 2 hypervisors are probably, if you have used virtual machines, these are probably what you have used. Here what happens is you have your host operating system. This is the machine, or rather the OS that you run on your desktop or your laptop or on your server. And then the hypervisor actually runs as a process within the host operating system. There are other native applications that you may be running, your browsers or mail clients and so on. So you can then start a hypervisor and run a guest operating system inside. So there are two operating systems here, your host operating system and your guest operating system. So if you have run Linux in Windows or using VMware and so on, you are in this world. Because you are, what is running on the hardware is a host operating system. In this case, what is running on the hardware is a hypervisor itself. And then you run your VMware or Xen or Parallels on top of this, and then you run a guest OS, possibly a different guest OS in there. This is referred to as a type 2 hypervisor. Yes, question there. How do the different virtual machines share the NIC? So let's come to that. So the idea is to use virtual interfaces there and multiplex the virtual interface. But we'll talk about that in a moment. Let's talk about how to share the CPU first. then we'll talk about how to share the memory, and then we'll talk about IO devices. Okay, so at the very basic level, how does this virtualization concept work? Okay, to understand this, you have to go back and try to understand what a CPU gives you at the hardware level. Okay, most processors will support what is called a kernel mode and a user mode at the hardware level. Okay, these are also referred to as protection rings. Okay, so you will have a ring 0, ring 1, ring 3. So ring 0 typically means kernel level, and ring 3 on x86 means user mode. Okay, now in the kernel, so what's the difference between these modes? There are some instructions that can only be executed if the CPU is running in kernel mode. Okay, and these instructions are referred to, we'll refer to them as sensitive instructions. Okay, these instructions do things that only the kernel should be allowed to do. If applications do them, then they are going to cause safety or protection issues. Okay, so things like changing page table mappings, okay, doing IO to devices, all of this only the kernel should do, in which case you run them in kernel mode. Okay, user processes are typically not allowed to execute them. Okay, so these instructions that we run in kernel mode, we'll call them a sensitive instruction. Okay, now all CPUs also support another set of instructions called privilege instructions. Now, if a user-level process executes a privilege instruction, it is going to cause a trap. Okay? The trap will typically call the operating system, and the operating system will then execute that privileged operation on your behalf. Okay? A sensitive instruction is one that typically only the kernel executes, so application never even executes. A privilege instruction is one that the application is allowed to execute, but it causes a trap, and the kernel will then actually execute it on your behalf. So any hardware is going to support both privileged and sensitive. Okay, these are two classes. Now, a key result that was actually published back in the 70s is that type 1 virtualization is feasible only if and only if the sensitive instructions are a subset of the privileged instructions. Okay, in other words, every sensitive instruction is also a privileged instruction. Okay, the reason for this should be clear. Why is this true? If you go back to your type 1 hypervisor, okay, this is Windows. Okay, it's an old kernel. It doesn't know it is actually running inside a virtual machine. As far as the VM is concerned, it gives it the illusion is running on bare hardware. Okay, and the kernel is actually going to execute sensitive instructions, okay, in kernel mode. Okay, but in this case, the kernel is not really a kernel. It's actually, as far as this is concerned, it's like an application. So if it executes a sensitive instruction, and if that sensitive instruction causes a trap, then the hypervisor can execute it on your behalf. Okay? If this does not happen, then your kernel is going to crash, okay, because it has executed a sensitive instruction in kernel mode, and it doesn't cause a trap, it doesn't get executed, because the hypervisor is the one that really has to execute it, the system is not going to work. Okay? So only if your sensitive instructions are also privileged instructions, which means that a kernel can now run it in user space and cause a trap and let the hypervisor implement that operation on your behalf, can you implement type 1 virtualization. Okay, is this clear? This is, I think, an interesting insight that you need to understand. Yes?
So I think you have a type of the line that begins privileged instruction.
Yes, cause a trap and execute it in user mode. That's definitely a typo. Yes. Okay. Now, that said, if you look at Intel 386 or x86 family, until recently, if you executed any kernel mode instructions in user mode, it wouldn't cause a trap, it would just ignore it. Okay. So, you take, let's say, you want to change page table mapping. If you execute this instruction in a user process, it just ignores the instruction, it doesn't do anything. It says this application is not in kernel mode, so this instruction is effectively ignored. Okay? So what this also tells you is that 386 family cannot support type 1 virtualization. Yeah, because if you actually ran this type 1 hypervisor on x86 and this Windows, which is now running in user space here, right? So this is running in user space, it executes a sensitive instruction, it's ignored by the hardware. The hypervisor doesn't even know it executed it, and system is going to malfunction. So you cannot do this on old Intel architecture. Okay. Now, recent recent as in just in the past year or two, they actually built hardware support in order to allow type 1 virtualization. So Intel has this set of extensions called VT, virtualization technology. Okay. AMD has something called SVM or Secure Virtual Machine. These are set of extensions that are made to the hardware to prevent this problem. Okay, otherwise, you cannot take type 1 hypervisors and run them. So what happens in this case is what does VT and SVM do is they allow you to create containers that where the VM can run. Okay. The hypervisor can use a hardware bitmap to say, so assume that instructions are numbered 1 through n. In this hardware bitmap, you just set bits saying if any application executes this instruction, trap to me. Okay. So although the instruction itself was not designed for a trap, the hypervisor can use this bitmap to say, I consider all of these instructions. In this case, you will pick all of the sensitive instructions and say, any sensitive instruction should be a trap. So you just set those bits, okay, at the hardware level. And so now whenever your operating system, which is running in user space, is going to execute that instruction, a sensitive instruction, because the hypervisor has specified it should trap, it will trap. Okay, if the bit is not set, it is not going to trap. But assumption is all type 1 hypervisors will do this, and then they will trap, and that allows you to emulate this result without changing it fundamentally at the hardware level. Okay, yes, question there.
That means in order to implement the type 1 system, we should provide hardware support for that, and then maybe we want to change some best OS operating system.
Right. So, question is, you need hardware support and then you need to modify the guest. You do need hardware support because if this result is not true, you cannot implement type 1 virtualization. We already agreed on that. We also said x86 architecture typically ignores sensitive instructions executing in user mode. Okay, so you cannot do it. So the only way you can do it is add some hardware features which says for these instructions, please trap. And you can turn this dynamically on and off. So if you're not running a hypervisor, then those instructions are that hardware bit is all zeros, so those instructions don't trap. You are in the normal behavior. But if you are running a type 1 hypervisor, you turn those bits on. Okay. Yes, question there.
So the result only applicable when the hardware doesn't support.
Yes, the result is only applicable when the hardware doesn't support it. There are processor families that do support it, but Intel is not one of them, which is also the most common hardware family. So this kind of virtualization wasn't enabled on that hardware family, which is why they had to make these extensions to support it. Okay, so they could have just done this, which is they could have made all of their sensitive instructions trap, but to prevent compatibility issues, they just decided to add this hardware mask that can be turned on and off. Okay. So this is basically the picture of what the type 1 hypervisor does. Okay, so the unmodified guest operating system is unmodified, no changes whatsoever. Okay, you take stock Linux or stock Windows, you run it in user space here. There's a type 1 hypervisor. This type 1 hypervisor, if you have VT support, has set this hardware mask. For every sensitive instruction, you set a 1 there. So whenever this user space Windows or Linux executes those instructions, you basically trap on these instructions. So effectively by doing this, you change these sensitive instructions into privileged ones. Okay? So now you trap on all privileged instructions, and then that hypervisor has to actually do that, whatever the kernel is asking. Okay? So effectively the hypervisor has become the kernel, the guest operating system has become what a user space process looks like. Okay? So you can have multiple of these, and here you will have a CPU scheduler that will have the notion of a conta and swap across operating systems and so on. This is how you can run multiple virtual machines on one hypervisor. Okay. So upon a trap, you will either execute the privileged instruction, or this is where the emulation comes in. If the instruction actually requires access to hardware devices that are virtualized, you emulate it. You may have a virtual disk rather than a real disk. So instead of making a real device driver call to bare hardware, you may actually make a call to a software file. Rather a file in software. Okay, that's where some of the emulation or executing privilege instructions comes in.
So in fact, this system just like at another lean level, except the lean theory and this data.
Right.
In fact, at another
Yeah, so it has added a ring where you basically changed your sensitive to privilege instruction. That is true. Here you actually don't run these things in ring 3, you run them in ring 1. If you ran it in ring 3, then your applications can start mucking around with the kernel data structures because you have full access to memory. So you run the hypervisor in ring 0, which is kernel mode. Rings 1, 2 and 3 are all user space, but they still provide higher levels of protection. Anything in ring 3 cannot talk, change anything that is running in ring 2 and so on. Okay, so the guest OS is going to run in ring 1, just as an example. Okay, so quickly I'll talk about type 2 hypervisor and then we can resume this next time. Okay, remember what type 2 hypervisors are. Is this scenario where you have your regular host operating system on your laptop or desktop, you're running VMware and running some other operating system in there. So the same problem is going to be there. Your guest operating system thinks it is running on bare hardware. It is going to go and execute privilege instructions, or rather sensitive instruction. Okay. Now question is, how do you handle them here? Okay. Here we decided to add some hardware support and some bit mask. So what do you do here? So in this case, what happens is we don't change the hardware. We want to still run on old hardware, okay, X86 hardware where there is no VT support. So what the virtual machine does is that it actually analyzes the code that the kernel is executing on the fly. Okay? So it basically looks at the code that the kernel is executing and it actually marks all of the sensitive instructions in there. Okay? And it replaces these sensitive instructions with function calls to itself. Okay? So this is effectively doing what is called binary translation. You are looking at the binary of, let's say, the operating system itself or a privileged process like a daemon process, and you are analyzing it on the fly saying, are there any sensitive instructions in here? If there are sensitive instructions, let's replace them with custom system function calls. Okay? So whenever those, and this is done as when the process is actually in memory and running. So what this does is, so whenever you hit those instructions, rather than executing that instruction, now you make a call, and that call effectively emulates what that instruction would have done at the VMware level or whatever or VM you are using. Okay, so this is going to basically make, now instead of a sensitive instruction, you have a function call that you have replaced it with. So that calls this, and this is going to implement whatever that instruction did for you. Okay. So by doing this, you can still run without any VT support because you are analyzing the code on the fly and replacing those sensitive instructions with something else. Okay, you can replace them with a custom interrupt, for example. Every sensitive instruction gets its own custom interrupt. Okay. So whenever that, so if you have interrupt 10, I'm just making something up, you know that what that instruction was, so you basically in the interrupt service routine, you would do what that instruction would have done. Okay. So this is how you can now run on unmodified hardware, meaning that you'd without this VT support, and yet do all of the stuff that you wanted to. Yes, question here. What do you mean on the fly? On the fly as in, so what it would do is, let's say there is a process that is running here. Okay? You analyze this process to mark out what are called basic blocks. Basic blocks are sequential blocks of instruction. And so you will analyze this thing, does this basic block that is currently being executed in the code cache have any sensitive instruction? If so, you will basically replace that instruction with a custom instruction.
This is done when the basic block is loaded or when the program...
When the program is running, you basically look at where the program counter is and you analyze the next few instructions.
If you run at native speed, I mean, if every instruction has to be going through the hypervisor
right.
to be scanned,
right. How do you run them? So what you would do is, you would basically scan, so while you're executing this, you will scan the next basic block, for example, and load it into a code cache. Okay? This would be a translated version of the basic block that's already loaded in the cache. Once it's loaded in the cache, you can execute it at native speed. You're not checking at each instruction. You're just checking blocks at a time, and when you translate that block, you load it into a cache, you run it. Okay? If your next block is not ready by the time this block ends, you will stall, and then you'll have to analyze it and load it into the code cache. So that's what is said here. While you execute, you analyze and load the next basic block.
This is only done basically when the basic block is loaded into the instruction cache and then you run.
Yes. So as you are executing, you analyze the next, if this is assumed to be a sequential program, right? So you analyze the next basic block and you see if, does it have sensitive instructions? If so, you change those instructions with your custom calls and then you load it in the cache. And when the instruction program counter appears, comes here, you just run it at native speed because you have translated all of those. And but there are going to be stalls. If there is a jump and you go somewhere else and that basic block hasn't been analyzed, you will stall until it's analyzed and loaded into the code cache. Yes, but if it's already done, then you don't worry about it. So this is how you would implement a type 2 hypervisor. So it is doing binary translations of sensitive instructions on the fly. Okay? In the previous case, you added hardware support. Here you are just creating your own instruction set, custom instruction set, and you are implementing that. Is this clear? So that's where we are going to stop. Let's resume this next time because we have a few more slides to go.